Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton, and the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out.
It is awfully troubling when you look at what was released and you hear about the police officer who shot Michael Brown Jr. in broad daylight, the unarmed teenager, and you hear he testified for 4 hours, and you had to scratch your head, kind of like we all did, to say, when is the prosecutor going to cross-examine the killer of an unarmed person? A first-year law student would have did a better job of cross-examining a killer of an unarmed person than the prosecutor's office did.
That was Benjamin Crump, the attorney for Michael Brown's family, speaking at a press conference today in Ferguson, Missouri. 61 people were arrested, many of them for burglary and trespassing, and at least a dozen buildings were burned in Ferguson last night. The grand jury decided that police officer Darren Wilson should not be prosecuted for shooting and killing 18-year-old Michael Brown. There were protests in cities across the country, including here in Los Angeles. Chris King is managing editor of the St. Louis American and African American Weekly newspaper in St. Louis, Missouri. Thanks for being with us again, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, we've seen a lot of images from last night on TV of buildings being burned, of people protesting some violently. What's the situation now?
Well, it's a busy day. There are a lot of civic leaders in the Black community and in the mainstream community that are knocking heads and trying to figure out what they can do to immediately deal with things. Protests are ongoing, almost invariably peaceful during the day, and they've been peaceful today. And, of course, the family is still grieving and raging, and much of the community, I would say, is grieving and raging.
Right. And you've been close to what's been happening in the community. I'm just curious, short of a different verdict, was there ever a chance that there wasn't going to be some kind of reaction that we saw last night?
Well, I think the decision was preordained by the demographics of that grand jury, which was convened before Michael Brown Jr. was killed, so it's not the prosecutor's doing, it was the judge that convened it. And just given the demographics, this was going to be the result, and everyone really thought there was going to be a hard, bad, long night, and there certainly was.
When you say demographics, you mean that there were two African-Americans on the grand jury?
Three out of 12, and nine have to agree on an indictment. And given the white majority in St. Louis County elects this exact prosecutor who's driven everyone crazy on this case, you can see that it's pretty predictable that the same white voter demographics that support this prosecutor would not hand down an indictment on a white police officer who killed a Black young man who had, we all agree, had some kind of altercation with the cop before the shooting.
Well, tell me more about what you just said about the prosecutor driving everyone crazy. What do you mean by that?
Well, Robert McCulloch was pressured by everybody you could imagine to recuse himself from the case. He has a close attachment to law enforcement. His father was a police officer killed by a Black man while on duty, and that's a demon he has to exercise. And he has an authoritarian personality that just wasn't going to play well in such a volatile situation, but he stubbornly dug in and stayed. And then the way he conducted the grand jury was very suspect to many people. He was seen as burying untutored jurors in evidence and information rather than doing what a prosecutor might do, which is decide what the person should be charged for and try to make that case, which is what a prosecutor does, we believe, when they want an indictment.
Right. We're going to talk a little bit more about the legal questions in just a moment. But I just, you know, there are some questions as to whether why he impaneled a grand jury to begin with.
Well, that's a standing jury. A district judge routinely does it. This one was held over because of this case, but that's a standard process. The judge convenes the grand jury. The prosecutor just takes evidence to it.
But he couldn't have just indicted the officer Darren Wilson?
Well, he could have brought criminal charges without going through the grand jury process. I believe that's what we called for at our newspaper. I think it would have been a big step, a very, very nervy step. Most people believe law enforcement officer deserves the the due process of the grand jury. You understand the grand jury is basically a bit of a double way to cross-check your work. You basically say, I think this is a good charge. Do you 12 people agree there's probable cause before I drag this person into court and issue subpoenas and put their name in the newspapers? Is it fair that we charge this person with this crime? Grand jury is not unfair to do in this situation. Just the way he handled it seemed to be designed to let the suspect wiggle off the hook.
Right. Okay, so there is a lot of unhappiness in Ferguson today. And moving forward, there are a couple of federal investigations happening. Do people think that those will be handled in a different manner?
Well, there is a federal civil rights investigation in the same shooting. That almost certainly will go nowhere. However, very importantly, Attorney General Eric Holder started a pattern or practice probe into the Ferguson Police Department and empowered his investigators to widen the probe to other municipal police departments as needed. These almost always end in expensive and demanding consent decrees where police departments have to shape up and sign a deal, basically, with the federal government to stay in business. And we expect in about a year, this takes these things about a year, Ferguson Police Department will get its consent decree, will not be able to afford it, to afford to monitor it, and will dissolve and contract with the St. Louis County Police Department. That would be a very good thing for the people of Ferguson. The St. Louis County Police Department, much larger, much more professional police department, 850 cops as opposed to 53 in Ferguson.
Hmm. Talk a little bit about how community activists are handling, you know, the protests and what's could happen tonight. Are there calls for people to be more peaceful than they were last night?
Well, see, the peaceful protesters were not what we saw on CNN and MSNBC last night. The peaceful protesters were out today doing what they've done for 110 days, and they'll be out tonight doing that. What was different last night was we had a whole bunch of people come back out we had not seen since August. These folks aren't really truly protesters. I think they're really better considered opportunists who flock to the opportunity to confront the police and express their legitimate grievances with the police, but not so much in a principled protest way. And then there are also really two sets of outside agitators who have infiltrated the movement deliberately, and both have a penchant for arson. And, of course, we saw how that played out last night.
Right. And where are they from?
Well, one is basically international and internet-based, and the other is national and takes a lot of pride in who they are, publishes a newspaper, calls attention to themselves. But I'd rather not name either group because I don't want to help recruit for them.
Right. So how does Ferguson prevent that from happening again tonight, and what are business owners doing?
Well, business owners are bracing in or closing or both, and the police have to reevaluate their game plan. I think they need to take more seriously some of the intelligence that the governor was scared by. I don't know why they didn't act more aggressively last night when they saw things happening, but they had a chance, I think, to defuse that in a different way.
Okay. Chris King, managing editor of the St. Louis American and African American Weekly newspaper in St. Louis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And let's take a look at the legal process that took place in Ferguson. Lori Levinson, professor of criminal law at Loyola Law School and a former federal prosecutor. Hi, Lori.
Good to join you.
Now, I understand that you have been reading through a lot of the transcripts from the grand jury. What do you think? Do you think that the grand jury made the right decision or not?
There's 24 volumes of transcripts, and I am plowing through them, but it's almost like a Rorschach test. You can certainly find the information in this grand jury proceeding to justify the decision by this grand jury. You know, they had Wilson testify. They had other people come forward and say, we didn't tell the media because we were afraid, but we think the officer made the right call. So you can understand why the grand jury reached its decision. On the other hand, you have witnesses all over the place who are testifying before this grand jury.
Okay, so as a former prosecutor, tell us a little bit about the process, the grand jury process. I mean, we just heard from Chris King that it seemed pretty unusual to bury the grand jury in 4,700 pages of testimony and documents.
This was unusual, and people should keep in mind there's actually two types of grand jury. There's a federal grand jury and a state grand jury. This was a state grand jury, and they don't do the regular charging. Usually what happens is a prosecutor files a complaint, and then we have a preliminary hearing. But every so often, there are these high-visibility cases, political hot potatoes, and the prosecutor will go to the grand jury to make the call. And there are 12 people in Missouri. They don't have a legal background, but it is the prosecutor who decides what evidence they'll hear. In the ordinary case, the prosecutor will come forward and say, I want this indictment, and here's my evidence to support it. Do you think it's enough? This wasn't that situation. This was throwing everything at the grand jury and saying, here are five possible indictments. Do you want to vote for them or vote against them?
So, in effect, kind of carrying out a mini trial, which is not the purpose, right, of a grand jury
investigation. It was a mini trial, but it was a mini trial without the type of cross-examination you would see in the trial. It was a mini trial without a judge to supervise the thing. And it was sort of a proceeding where grand jurors were making a lot of the decisions that prosecutors often make along the way.
Okay, so Benjamin Crump, the attorney for Michael Brown's family, spoke today, and I just want to play a clip of tape from his news conference earlier and have you react to it.
We object to this process because all across America, whether it's in New York, Los Angeles, California, Cleveland, young people of color are being killed by police officers, and the local prosecutors put together this fair and unbiased grand jury, and it continues to yield the same results.
Okay, so he basically went on to say that it is particularly hard to prosecute police officers in cases like this, and there needs to be maybe a rethinking of the way these shootings are handled.
Well, I think it's true that it's very, very hard to bring charges against a police officer across the state, and we've seen this. In fact, in this case, I'm not sure, frankly, that it would come out differently under a federal investigation and a federal grand jury. It's just that we give these police officers the right to use force in the right situation, and then it's going to be up to the grand jury to say, hey, was this a situation to use force?
Right. And so how often are police officers then indicted when they come before a grand jury?
Actually, it's very hard to even get the indictment against police officers. Occasionally it happens. We can think back to the Rodney King case. Mm-hmm. But I, as a former federal prosecutor, had cases of excessive force where the grand jury was not prepared to indict.
And is that just because there's a bias in favor of police officers being, you know, on in the line of fire, so to speak, and in a very difficult situation, and there's just a bias in favor of accepting their version of events?
I think there's both a bias, and I also think that the law says that police officers can use force. Mm-hmm. And there's no drawn line as to, in this case, yes, this case, no. So oftentimes the police officers are just given the benefit of the doubt that they did reasonably fear for their life because it's all happening so fast out on the streets.
Well, let's talk also about eyewitness testimony. I believe there were at least 24 eyewitnesses brought before the grand jury, and some of them said different things at different times, and it seemed to be a little confusing. Is this basically revealing how unreliable eyewitness testimony can be?
It absolutely does. I mean, I would say that these transcripts are Exhibit A for the problems with eyewitness testimony, because you have testimony all over the place. People don't have the same vantage points. They change their statements, their inconsistencies. And I think most of these people sincerely believed that they knew what happened, but when you take a look at the eyewitness testimonies, you realize how many possibilities for distortions and mistakes there are.
And so should these cases just rely on the forensic evidence then? And in this case, it showed that none of the shots were fired into Michael Brown's back.
I don't think that you can pick just one type of evidence and know the answer. So I don't think it would have made a difference here if you just went with forensic evidence. What the hard part of this job is in putting together a case is putting together the puzzle, the eyewitness testimonies, the statements by the target himself, the physical evidence, and then just sort of making the best judgment as to whether there should be charges.
Right. And charges, not a decision whether or not there was guilt.
That has to be done by a jury, and it's only before the jury that you're going to have the type of questioning that you can actually trust to get the verdict. The questioning in this grand jury, I would say, at best, was inconsistent.
Hmm. And now, is it possible that a special prosecutor could come in and indict Darren Wilson?
You know, legally it would have been possible, but it's not going to happen because I think that this prosecution office has decided they don't think there should be charges based upon the grand jury's finding. And given that the feds were doing a very similar investigation, I think they'll come to that conclusion as well. So I think the ship has sailed. If they had decided early on to bring in a special prosecutor, there would have been more confidence in what this grand jury's done, but I'm not actually sure that the result would have been different.
Lori, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
That's Lori Levinson. She's a former federal prosecutor, and she teaches criminal law at Loyola Law School. Well, we would like to hear your reaction to the grand jury decision. Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Okay, we have another horrific story. It's unfolding at the University of Virginia campus. The Rolling Stone reporter who detailed a shocking gang rape at a frat is here to tell us that story. Her story has prompted big protests and calls for major changes in the campus culture at UVA. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The University of Virginia's governing board is holding an emergency meeting today to talk about how the school handles sexual assault cases. The meeting is in response to a Rolling Stone article that detailed an alleged gang rape at a UVA frat house 2 years ago and the weak response by school officials. The Rolling Stone story also describes a decades-long history of mishandling and covering up sexual violence at UVA. All week on the campus, students have held demonstrations and fraternities are suspended until the end of the year. But why are these allegations only coming to light now? Sabrina Rubin-Erdely wrote the article, and she's here now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we've just said, there's been a big reaction to your article. Did you expect there to be such a big reaction?
No, I did not. I mean, I expected there to be some kind of reaction. My hope was that it was going to be widely read, but the reaction has been absolutely huge. People have been reacting just with shock and horror. Personally, I've gotten hundreds of messages, you know, emails and voicemails from people, you know, many of them students or UVA graduates and students from elsewhere saying that they had similar experiences with sexual assault and the silence that greeted them afterwards and thanking me for writing the article and hoping that, you know, by shedding some light, maybe something will change.
Right. And this is not the first article to be written this year or recently about sexual assault on campus. Why do you think that the story of the girl you place at the center of your story, Jackie, why do you think her story resonated so much?
I think it's possible that her story really resonated because it was just so extreme. The narrative about campus rape up until recently has kind of devolved into this discussion about, well, is this really sexual assault or is it really just kind of a misunderstanding between drunk people? And I think that Jackie's case really makes it clear that even in a case as extreme as hers, she was still disbelieved by her friends. She was treated exactly the way your sort of typical rape victim is treated.
Could you describe what happened so people know exactly what the story is that we're talking about?
Sure. Jackie was a freshman in her first weeks of her freshman year when she was invited out on a date by a junior to his fraternity house. He took her out to dinner first. He was a perfect gentleman at first. He picked her up from her dorm room. He took her out to dinner, and then he took her to a fraternity party. And while there, he took her upstairs and into a bedroom. And she said that in that bedroom, waiting in there in the dark, were seven men who took turns raping her for the next 3 hours while her date gave them instruction and encouragement. Jackie also became aware, she told administrators a year after she reported her own allegations, she went back to administrators to tell them that she had become aware of two other women who actually said that they had also been gang raped in that same house.
And what was the response on the part of the administrators?
Well, the administrator that she went to is a dean who is sort of responsible for all sexual assault intake complaints. And her response was to express concern over Jackie's mental health and then to very neutrally present her with the options that she could take. She said that Jackie could either file a complaint within the school, and she had a couple of options there, or she could go to police, or basically she could do nothing at all. The end result of this very neutral kind of whatever you want to do is fine by us, even if you do nothing, is that very often these victims do wind up doing nothing, and they're told that that choice is perfectly okay, too. When I really, really pressured UVA to give me statistics about how many people came in to report sexual assaults, they had said that over the last year, 38 people had come into this dean's office to make complaints about sexual assaults, but that only 9 of them had gone forward with formal complaints. So you kind of wonder what happened to the rest of them.
And so you also describe in your article that the administrators didn't want to talk to you at first about this.
Yes, they were very unhappy with my writing this article. The press office refused to let me speak with some key people on campus who were really best equipped to answer my questions about the handling of sexual assault, including this sexual assault intake dean. In fact, I had an interview set up with her. And while I was on my way down to Charlottesville, the press officer emailed me to say that he had canceled my interview. They were very reluctant to give me statistics for the article. Eventually, they allowed me to have a conference call with President Sullivan and someone from the Dean of Students Office, but they were really essentially rather unhelpful. They mostly said, "I don't know." And actually, their resistance went even farther than I detailed in the article. I found out as I was finishing up my article that UVA had commissioned an article in the UVA Alumni Magazine that was meant to be a counterpoint to my article, even though, of course, they hadn't even seen my article yet because it hadn't even been written yet. But the writer of that Alumni Magazine article interviewed some of the same women that I interviewed, and the sense that these women had was that she was trying to undermine their credibility and that this was actually a hit piece not just on my article but on them. So if that's true, I mean, it really goes to show how far UVA would go to protect its own reputation, that it would be willing to throw its own students under the bus.
Okay, so now it seems that the opposite is happening. They're having this emergency Board of Governors meeting. They've suspended the fraternities. There have been protests on campus. So what do you expect to come out of all of this?
Well, what I'm hoping is that this is going to be the beginning of a sort of long period of introspection that is going to begin to really change the culture. I would like to see, they've got their work cut out for them. They're going to need to make some major changes to the fraternity culture, which is essentially an unsafe environment for women. And they're going to have to make some major changes in terms of the administration's policies and procedures in order to handle sexual assault correctly and to encourage people to come forward and report. So I expect there to be some drastic changes.
And I guess the overall question is UVA an outlier, or is this something that is par for the course on most college campuses?
Well, that's, I guess, in a way, the most disturbing part, which is that part of the reason why I chose UVA was because I thought that it was, from all of my research and speaking to people and stuff, that it really seemed like a very typical place in terms of college social life and the way that sexual assault played out. So even though what I found there is really horrifying, the really frightening part is that I have reason to believe that the culture at University of Virginia is in no way unique to UVA, that this culture of degradation of women, sexual assault, and this indifference to rape victims and hiding their, discouraging their reports, that this is really probably typical of colleges across the country.
Sabrina Rubin-Erdely is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. Her article, A Rape on Campus, A Brutal Assault and Struggle for Justice at UVA, is in the latest issue. Sabrina, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the program, how Angelica Houston navigated her glamorous and sometimes lonely life in Hollywood. That's next on Press Play after a news update with Steve Chiotakis.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Actress Angelica Houston has played many iconic Hollywood characters. Morticia Adams in The Addams Family, Ethelene Tenenbaum in The Royal Tenenbaums, May Rose Pritzi in Pritzi's Honor, and she won an Oscar for that one. But for her latest project, Angelica Houston is starring herself. She's written a new autobiography. It's called Watch Me. It covers her years in Hollywood and is a follow-up to her first memoir released last year. Angelica Houston, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks, Madeline.
All right, so the beginning of this book, you've ended a relationship with the photographer Bob Richardson, much older man. You were, what, 18 at the time?
Yeah, he was 42. Bob was bipolar and schizophrenic, which I didn't know when we were first together.
And so the two of you, you ended that relationship and then decided to come to Los Angeles after that. And you were part of, I guess, Hollywood royalty at the time, if you want to call it royalty. I don't know, the star scene in the 1970s. And you paint quite a glamorous picture of what it was like back then.
Well, people call it Hollywood royalty. I don't know how royal it was, but I'm third generation movies, and my father was a director, my grandfather was an actor, so I have a history in a town that doesn't have much, I think.
Yeah, royalty for Hollywood.
Being in Los Angeles in those first days of the early 70s, it was a very exciting place to be. I say in the book that it was both very glamorous and a little provincial at the time, because when I think of it now, maybe there were 10 restaurants that you went to. It wasn't this sort of vast arena that it is today. And L.A. always appeared to me like, well, it was Sun City to begin with. Just the temperature alone made it attractive to me, coming from London and Ireland, where it rained all the time and was cold. And L.A. was populated with very beautiful people. I mean, if you lived in Ireland and England and New York for years, you know, you'd have gotten used to quite pasty-faced working people, citified people in New York. And then in Los Angeles, everyone seemed to be, you know, wearing leisure suits and waiting for lovely things to happen to them.
So it must have been a great relief from the tempestuous chapter that you had just had in New York.
Yeah.
With Bob Richardson. How did you meet Jack Nicholson?
I was invited to a party at his house, and I went with my stepmother. He opened the door to his house, and I thought immediately he was the most attractive man I'd met in years.
And it wasn't just his looks. It was his whole
No, it was
being.
mostly his looks.
It was. And he was already a star then.
Yeah.
He'd already done Easy Rider.
Not a huge star. He'd done Easy Rider. I think it was before Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. So Chinatown, he starred in with your father and directed by Roman Polanski.
Right.
And you were with Jack Nicholson then. You were living with him at
yeah.
the time?
Yeah.
So what was it like to be around both your father and Jack Nicholson at the time of shooting this movie, Chinatown?
I remember a sort of incident of going along to visit them on the set, and they were at a long refectory table in an orchard and having lunch, and Polanski was at the head of the table and my father was opposite, and I sat down next to Jack, and my father kind of turned to Jack and said, "I hear you've been sleeping with my daughter." And there was this long pause in which I felt the blood rushing to my cheeks. And then he said, "Mr. Gitz," which was, of course, Jack's character's name in the movie. And I realized that, you know, he was teasing us.
But it was in character.
He was in character and he was reading from the script, but he was, trying it out.
What did he think of your romance with Jack Nicholson?
I'm sure he was thrilled, yeah. He admired Jack. He liked him as an actor. He liked him even better as a person.
And did he see himself a little bit in Jack Nicholson?
I have no idea.
Do you see a little bit of him in Jack Nicholson?
I think there are comparisons. I don't think I saw one in the other. I think I saw them both as who they were and with similarities, but I don't think they really occupied each other's territory at all.
But the similarities being that they are very big, dominant presences in your life, as I read your book.
Definitely, yeah.
I guess I'm just wondering, when it comes to Jack Nicholson, you're an adult, and so you have obviously a different relationship to him and to power and to this kind of intimate relationship with a very strong man. If you felt like you were an equal to Jack in your relationship.
Definitely. I've never felt like I wasn't an equal in any relationship.
But the fact that he slept with other women when he was with you really bothered you.
Well, it didn't thrill me.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was sort of a part of the parcel. My father was not a particularly faithful man either. For me, it was something that I was very invested in. I think he was very invested with me, the fact that he wasn't particularly faithful wasn't something that I think was all that that he saw as all that important.
And then in, I guess, a period where you were upset by his philandering, you left and decided to have a relationship with Ryan O'Neill.
Well, I didn't plan it. Uh-huh. He came up to me at a party and was particularly complimentary, and Jack was out of town at the time and had given me a poor excuse as to why he wasn't bringing me with him. And I think I was just in the mood to be spoiled a little.
But that didn't last long, that relationship, because it turned out that he had a dark side.
Yeah.
Well, he physically beat you, you write in the book.
He gave me what the British call a nutter, which is he basically hit me in the head with his head.
Ooh.
I don't want to categorize, you know, somebody as a man who beats up women, but he made a mistake, and it seemed only right that I should then remove myself from the situation.
And then you went back to Jack after that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he gets another woman pregnant.
Yeah.
And that's the end of your relationship.
It was not just that, but there was an additional sort of insult of an article that had come out in Playboy magazine, which had him sort of ping-pong batting some young woman in an amorous situation. And for some reason, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. Pregnancy was not great, but the second piece of information just seemed not only hurtful but careless. You know, it wasn't that it was a big surprise to me to be there. I was always concerned with what I would do. And I think actually it was a bit frustrating to be with Jack because I wanted to be an actor on my own terms.
So then you fast forward to the main part of your acting. Well, I guess you're still acting, I should say.
I like to think so.
In the films, I'm thinking of Pritzi's Honor, for example, The Addams Family, these great roles. And I guess I'm wondering how those roles, what they did for you and your stature and your, I don't know, your sense of yourself as a leading lady.
Well, Preetzi's honor came to me at a time when I was ready to do it. It was the second movie I made with my dad. His producer, John Foreman, he produced a book called Preetzi's Honor, which he gave to me and asked me what I thought about the character of May Rose, which, of course, I loved. And then he said, well, what about your dad to direct and Jack to co-star? And I thought, oh, God, no. You know, I wanted to do it by myself. I didn't necessarily want to be sandwiched between these two big guys. But it turned out really well. Everybody got along, and I was nominated for an Academy Award, which, shockingly, I won. And
you were the only one to win.
I was, yeah. We had 7 nominations, I think. And it was hard to be the only one to win, in a way.
Especially when your dad and Jack Nicholson didn't.
Of course, yeah.
I assume that they were over the moon for you.
They were very sweet and very happy for me.
Good. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with actress and director Angelica Houston about her new autobiography. It's called Watch Me. After you left Jack, you met and married the artist and sculptor Bob Graham. And the way you portray this relationship in your book, it seems that he was the love of your life.
Bob was a fantastic man, beautiful artist, a beautiful man with a very extraordinary talent that I was in awe of. And yeah, I felt very lucky to have met him, to have known him, to have married him, to have lived with him for some 22 years.
And how was he different for you in terms of your relationships with men, your intimate relationships? How is this one different?
I would say that Bob was very trustworthy, entirely trustworthy. Not that it diminished his attractiveness. And it was odd because he sculpted naked women for the most part. But I have to say, for somebody who's sort of naturally quite jealous, it never gave me pause. I never thought twice about it. And I think that's because I felt that his attention was very focused on me.
Did he ever sculpt you?
Yes. That was hard because we were in an intimate relationship, and something about the act of posing for somebody it's another layer. It's another skin off the onion. And it required that I expose myself in a way that, you know, when you're doing fashion pictures, for instance, or even publicity pictures, you present a version of yourself, like a kind of idealized version of yourself. But with a sculptor, it's different. You're showing something about yourself that's not necessarily an idealized version of yourself.
He died in 2008.
Yes.
So how was it writing these very intimate scenes in this book when you had to sit down in front of your computer? I don't know how you write in front of a computer.
No.
With a pen.
I write by hand.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
But you had to go back and relive all these moments, and pretty tough moments, especially when it comes to the death of your husband. And
you know, those moments, unless you feel sad when you're writing them, or unless they're hard, are meaningless. So in a way, that's part of what you take on. You're writing about sad things. It's like sense memory. An actor has to do that all the time. So for me, if it hadn't hurt, or if it hadn't felt sad to write about certain things, I'd have been much more worried.
When you reread what you wrote and you see your younger self on the page, what do you think? Who do you see on the page?
Me. Me, if I feel like it's a successful rendering, or if I've managed to kind of reconjure that moment.
You don't see a character, you see an essence of you.
No, it's me. It's where I was, it's how I was thinking, it's pretty much why I made the decisions I made. So I don't have a lot of those moments where I regret one thing and wish I'd done another. You know, from my point of view now, I think I was acting out on the information that I had and trying to do my best, and a lot of the time maybe not making great decisions, but they were my decisions.
Well, Angelica Houston, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Angelica Houston. Her new book is called Watch Me. Let's listen to Warren Olney now.
And at 1 o'clock, when we start our program, we'll start out in Ferguson and get a sense of what it's like there this morning and how people are feeling, particularly about the police. After all that burning, get a sense of what the business people are saying. And then we'll get some very interesting reactions and analyses of what's going on, what this means in terms of the history of the country. Talking to one person who says that if you look at a map of the cities where there were disturbances yesterday and overnight, it's the same places where African Americans came in the early part of the 20th century to avoid Jim Crow in the South, and illustrates the broken promises that we all know so well.
All right. Look forward to that fascinating discussion at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, want to know how many calories are in that margarita at TGI Fridays or in that tub of popcorn at the movie theater? No? Well, you won't be able to avoid it. New rules come into effect pretty soon. We'll tell you about it coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you've ever wondered how many calories there are in that tub of buttered popcorn you get at the movies, it looks like you're about to find out whether you want to or not. This morning, the FDA announced new rules that will require movie theaters to post calorie counts, but that is just the tip of the fat-filled iceberg. Chain restaurants, vending machines, and amusement parks will have to post nutritional information too. Food labeling was mandated under a provision of the Affordable Care Act as a way to fight the obesity epidemic. But just who would be included has been the subject of intense lobbying. Stephanie Strom has been covering that story for the New York Times, and she's here now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, who and what is covered?
Well, it is basically any restaurant chain that has more than 20 restaurants in it, convenience stores that have salad bars or hot food buffets that people come in and pick up things, you know, a meal from, grocery stores that have deli counters where they prepare sandwiches and things like that, and as you mentioned, movie theaters and amusement parks. Also, stadiums that have, say, a Subway restaurant inside of them, the Subway restaurant inside would be required to label as well.
Mm-hmm. And pizza restaurants as well?
Pizza restaurants, for sure. That was one of the Commissioner Hamburg at the FDA said that was one of the hardest things that they had to deal with, because pizza is, by its very nature, a customizable item. So, you know, each person is going to order pizza differently with, you know, their favorite toppings.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the pizza industry argued that, you know, by posting the calorie count on a full pie, you weren't really giving the consumer an accurate portrayal of how many calories they were actually going to be eating. So there was a lot of wrangling about this. A lot of lobbying went on. The pizza restaurants managed to persuade the FDA that they could label by slice, and they get to define the size of the slice. But the quid pro quo is, okay, you can do that, but you also have to tell us in that particular pizza how many calories are in that pizza. they don't have to label calories for every permutation of pizza, but for the standards, pepperoni pizza, Hawaiian pizza, cheese pizza, they're supposed to give a calorie count.
So I imagine it's not just pizza joints that have their nose out of joint. But other food industries didn't like, no one liked this in the food industry, right? They didn't
want
to do this.
The National Restaurant Association, which represents most of the big chains, it's the largest trade association, they actually were in favor of this. They were facing a thicket of local, county, and state laws on labeling. Like, we have a labeling law, a calorie labeling law here in New York City. There are several in California. Montgomery County outside of Washington, D.C. has one. And they were, it was driving them crazy because they were all slightly different. So they went to the FDA and said, could you please come up with a national standard where it levels the playing field, everybody gets the same information from Maine all the way to Alaska. And so that's what the FDA did. That's what went into the law, the congressional law. That's what, you know, Congress ordered this. But the problem is that then when the FDA started looking at where people actually eat, they realized a lot of people are getting meals from grocery stores. You know, busy women go in, they pick up the night's meal, and they take it home. A lot of men get their dinners and lunches from convenience stores. A lot of food, snack food, is being consumed in movie theaters. So they broadened it, and some argue that that's not what Congress intended, to include the other places where Americans tend to eat.
So public health advocates must be thrilled with us.
Public health advocates did not expect the FDA to go as far as it did, and were very pleased. They were not sure. I talked with somebody yesterday morning, and she was not sure whether the convenience stores would be included. They also were surprised by the inclusion of alcohol in this.
So, at bars or just at restaurants?
At restaurants, if you go into a bar and have a mixed drink, like you sidle up to the bar and say, I want a gin tonic, that's not going to be labeled. But if you're sitting in a restaurant and you want to order a glass of wine, you'll see how many calories are in that glass of wine on the menu or on the menu board.
Now, these rules were released after the midterm elections. Was that done on purpose?
That's a good question. Nobody really knows why it has taken the FDA so long to get these rules in place. The law was passed in 2010, and everyone expected to see the rules in 2011. It's now 2014, and we finally have the rules. There's really no clarity on why it's taken so long.
Is there any clarity on whether these rules actually work to prevent obesity?
That is also a subject of intense debate. There was a famous study done back when New York City passed its calorie listing requirements, and somebody went around and studied Starbucks, whether it had any impact on the amount of calories people were ordering at Starbucks, because some of the calorie counts at that time were pretty shocking. And they found only a 6% decline in the amount of calories consumed. And the food advocates actually considered that a good thing, because they often will make the point that you don't have to move the needle very far on calorie consumption per day to really make a difference in the obesity problem. So I was talking with someone yesterday who said that if every American, you know, if you did it on average, and all 300 and some odd million of us cut our calorie consumption by between 30 and 50 calories a day, you'd make a huge dent in the obesity problem. Of course, the fact of the matter is not all 300 and some odd million of us need to cut calories like that. So you would have to, it would really have to be the people who needed it most who would have to be most affected by these, and nobody knows whether that's going to happen or not.
By the way, my producer just looked up pumpkin spice latte at Starbucks, 380 calories.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot.
And, you know, I was talking with someone earlier today who said, well, you know, but if I go into the movie theater, I'm going to order the tub of popcorn anyway because, you know, it's a treat. That's what I want. I think what the FDA is hoping to do is to just make people more aware of how calorically expensive their treats are and maybe moderate consumption some way.
Okay, so now that the battle has been fought, won, lost, what have you, when are we going to see these calorie counts posted?
The calorie counts will be posted in the restaurants, convenience stores, grocery stores, et cetera. They have to do that within a year. Vending machines were also covered by these rules, and they have 2 years to get their act together.
Okay, well, I guess I'm looking forward to it. I don't know. Sometimes ignorance is bliss.
I agree.
Stephanie Strom, reporter for The New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Myers, deliver us from ignorance. What have our listeners been telling us?
Well, first, I want to fill you in on the things I don't want to know the caloric content of.
We don't have that much time.
Number one, beer. Number two, my dad's apple pie. And number three, my words when I need to eat them, which is often. So we talked about the grand jury decision in the case against police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson earlier in the show. As you can imagine, our listeners had plenty to say. Pain Happy on Facebook commented, he says that the residents of Ferguson have made justice a subjective affair, not subject to the system we have, which means that they'll never have any justice at all. Amy Fleiss says that it's hard to know what justice is if you don't first know the truth. She feels like both sides were embellishing to serve their own agendas. And here's a tweet from Ariel Yasmin. She says that a lack of indictment gives Black youth the message that our lives aren't worth enough to fight for. She followed up with another tweet about coverage in the media. She says somehow the narrative becomes about Black violence instead of the fact that brute force was used against an unarmed man. But there are so many comments on Facebook, Twitter. Lots of people called in today, and you guys should keep them coming.
Yeah, keep them coming. Twitter at KCRW Press Play, Facebook KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
To the Point with Warren Olney is up next. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.